combination therapies, of course, are becoming really quite popular in the clinic, and none more so than the combination of radiation with chemotherapy. Obviously, there are a lot of different classes of chemotherapeutic agents which are available for study. Often, unfortunately, many of the studies which have been done really are being empirical based rather than a scientific basis. The alkylating agents include nitrogen mustard derivatives, ethylenamines, the nitrosoureas, the alkyl sulfonates, hydrazines, triazines. All of these alkylating agents have different types of properties, but basically have in common the fact they have a highly reactive alkyl group, which is able to covalently bind to an intracellular molecule such as DNA. And generally, the bifunctional cross-linking agents are more effective because they're capable of causing interstrand DNA cross-links. The disadvantages associated with this class of agents is that they have limited cell cycle specificity and are, of course, carcinogenic. The platinating agents are something which is growing in terms of their use in cancer. The main agents are cisplatin, carboplatin, and oxaplatin. These agents exist in a 2+ oxidation state and interact with four groups or interact with the DNA to cause intra-strand and inter-strand cross-linking. The anti-metabolites as a class of agents include the purine pyrimidine analogues and the antifolates such as methotrexate. These agents tend to interfere with normal cell functions such as DNA synthesis. They are cell cycle specific, they cause DNA damage, they tend to block DNA repair. This has led to their use as radiosensitizers, for example, 5-FU and other purine analogues, pyrimidine analogues are commonly used along with radiation therapy. The topoisomerase inhibitors are interesting compounds. For many years, the mechanism by which camptothecin operated was not really known until Wang showed that what happened was that it relaxed double-strand DNA and that topoisomerases inhibitors blocked this relaxation process, and therefore they blocked replication. Topoisomerase inhibitors basically fall into three groups: TOPO1, TOPO2, and TOPO2 inhibitors that have other effects as well, such as the anthracyclines. Anthracyclines, of course, have effects far outside topoisomerase inhibition. For example, they act as proteasome inhibitors. The other important class of agents is the antimicrotubular agents, the vinca alkaloids, and the taxanes in particular. And these bind to tubulins and inhibit microtubular disassembly. In doing this, they cause cells to arrest, in particular in the G2M phase of the cell cycle. These agents, therefore, are thought to be perhaps useful in terms of interacting with radiation by causing cell cycle pile-up in a radiosensitive phase. There are a large variety of other agents, such as the proteasome inhibitors, bortezomib, Velcade, PS341, to give it its three names. This is a boronic acid dipeptide which inhibits proteasomes reversibly. This is an interesting drug because it became popular because it was very effective in multiple myeloma. unfortunately, many of the patients who show responses in drug refractory multiple myeloma to bortezomib later fail as other some drug resistant clones develop. Proteasome inhibitors have multiple effects, however, they cause cell cycle arrest, apoptosis, and they are immunosuppression agents and anti-inflammatory agents. One of their major effects is downregulation of NF-kappa-B, and by downregulating NF-kappa-B, they can act as radiosensitizers and chemosensitizers. And there are a number of clinical trials ongoing to look at proteasome inhibitors in combination with radiation therapy. When everyone thinks of this enormous array of chemotherapeutic agents, one has to take into account the fact that they vary enormously in terms of the pharmacokinetics and the pharmacodynamics. The kinetics are a measure of the concentration of metabolites over a period of time and are important with respect to the absorption, the distribution, the metabolism, and the rate of elimination of the drug. When one's thinking about the pharmacodynamics, one is more concerned about the cellular response to the drug. Pharmacokinetics is normally measured by the area under the curve. However, maintaining a certain level of drug may be important for some drugs, more important for some drugs than for other drugs. So for some agents, continuous delivery appears to be a much better approach than bolus administration. This is true for the TOPO1 inhibitors, other agents like 5-FU and also the taxanes. Drug absorption obviously depends upon the route of administration of the drug. For many drugs, the intravenous route is the preferred route. However, for some, oral is a better route, such as temozolomide. In certain specific circumstances, regional delivery may be more effective than either. For example, in glioma, where the blood-brain barrier can really be a major factor. The distribution of drug obviously requires blood flow or fluid flow through the tumor, and it also depends, of course, upon the diffusion kinetics. This is going to be influenced by the size of the drug and the chemical form of the drug, and what the drug binds to in terms of protein lipid solubility, the pH in the site where it is going. Metabolism of the drug is of course critical as well. Phase 1 active metabolites are often produced in the liver, whereas phase 2 inactive metabolites can be produced by conjugation with other agents. There are some drugs that require activation, and there are other drugs whose activation status is going to be strongly influenced by genetic polymorphisms. Certainly, in patients who are ill, liver function can easily affect the metabolism of the drug. Drug excretion is primarily in kidney or the biliary tract, and this can be associated with toxicity from phase 1 active metabolites or phase 2 metabolites, for example, with carboplatin and doxorubicin. Again, kidney function here can affect kidney clearance, and this can be compromised in cancer patients. And again, excretion of drugs and active metabolites can be influenced by what they bind to within the body. The pharmacodynamics of drugs really depends a lot upon the microenvironment within the tumor, the cell cycle phase, the drug resistance mechanisms that might be operating, the metabolism within the cell, and the sensitivity of the cell to cell death and survival pathways. It's very difficult to get good predictors from in vitro survival data for in vivo responses, and this makes sense when one considers just all the factors that go together to make up the pharmacodynamic responses. There are some drugs which are less effective on hypoxic areas, for example, bleomycin, procarbazine, daptomycin. On the other hand, there are other drugs which tend to be more effective in hypoxic than aerated situations. These are the, if you like, the hypoxic cytotoxins, such as mitomycin C, misinidazole, terpazamine, doxorubicin. The cell cycle is of critical importance for many drugs. Alkylating agents and cisplatin will tend to be effective in G1S phase. Docetaxel, methotrexate, hydroxyurea, vinblastine, doxorubicin are most effective in S phase, whereas the taxanes and paclitaxel, bleomycin will work primarily in the G2 phase and will cause G2 arrest. There are multiple mechanisms of drug resistance which are within the body. Some of these mechanisms will affect the uptake or the efflux of the drug. Some will result in a decrease in the activation status or an increase in the drug catabolism. Target molecules might become altered. The drug itself might bind, in particular, to sulfhydryl groups such as glutathione within the cell and become inactivated. There might be increased DNA repair in response to the drug, or a decreased ability for cells to undergo apoptosis in response to drug. Of these mechanisms of drug resistance, impaired drug influx will, of course, depend upon exactly how the drug gets into the cell. If it's by passive diffusion or facilitated diffusion or active transport. Passive diffusion will be energy and temperature independent, whereas facilitated diffusion will be dependent upon the transport carrier mechanisms on the membrane. Active transport is going to be energy and temperature dependent, and again will be a carrier-mediated process. Alterations in this carrier, for example, in the influx of folate into cells, possibly as a result of mutations in the carrier, or a decrease in the binding site for drugs, are possible mechanisms of increased resistance. Perhaps one of the most interesting mechanisms of drug resistance is the increased drug efflux, which can take place by a number of different mechanisms. But essentially, many natural drugs or derivatives have shared mechanisms of resistance that are based upon membrane-based ATPase-dependent pumps. The most classic one of these is the P-glycoprotein MDR1, which is expressed in high levels in kidneys and adrenals, and intermediate levels in lung, liver, colon, and rectum. These actually share specificity, surprisingly, with proteasome enzymes, and there are inhibitors that are available, for example, the calcium channel blockers for apamil, cyclosporine A, or talquirida, which are in trials or are thought to be effective in blocking this increased mechanism of drug resistance. Might be said that there is some evidence that this mechanism might be a particularly important mechanism with respect to stem cells. Stem cells appear to have increased ability to pump drugs out of their cells. So, in summary, there is a whole plethora of drugs available. Many of these are selective in the sense that they tend to target proliferating cells. the major problem with most of them is the mechanisms of drug resistance, and these are the principal mechanisms that exist which really lead to decreased efficacy of chemotherapeutic agents. And I think it's important to consider just how effective these agents are. In radiation therapy, we often point to our friends and colleagues in HemOnc as referring to responses as partial responses, or partial responses which are defined by a pathological or an imaging endpoint. It's important to realize that if a tumor has 10 to the 10 cells and a partial response may decrease this to 2 times 10 to the 9, this really isn't much of an improvement. This is the equivalent of 4 gray of radiation therapy. Withers has shown that patients who are in complete remission may have between 0 and 10 to the 9 cells in terms of a tumor burden. If in a group of patients there is a 10-year relapse-free survival of 30% without adjuvant chemotherapy and 40 to 45% with adjuvant chemotherapy, it can be calculated that in terms of tumor cell kill, this represents about 2 logs. And this is really relatively easy to achieve with radiation therapy. The other aspect of chemotherapy that has to be considered whenever you're combining neoadjuvant chemotherapy with radiation therapy is that chemotherapy, like radiation therapy, can actually cause accelerated tumor repopulation. And for this reason, concomitant delivery of drugs is often better than sequential delivery. Obviously, if one is combining drugs with radiation therapy, at the end of the day, one needs to increase the therapeutic index from this combination. Most chemotherapeutic agents have bone marrow as the major toxicity, and we treat to the maximal tolerated dose, except for palliative cases. Another issue to consider is that although some cancers will respond to chemotherapy initially at a very rapid rate, this doesn't necessarily mean to say that they are cured. One is only beginning to realize now that cancer stem cell issue can be a major problem for chemotherapy, in particular because cancer stem cells appear to have enhanced drug efflux pumps. So whenever one is embarking upon combination therapy, it's important to use different classes of agents with minimal overlapping toxicities. It's also possible to combine radiation therapy with chemotherapy, with adjuvant therapy, or with biological targeting. Combination with chemotherapy and radiation therapy is becoming increasingly used, particularly in head and neck cancers, but in other sites as well. Again, one has to realize that one is trying to increase the therapeutic ratio and the potential for increased normal tissue toxicity always exists. It's possible to quantify this using the dose enhancement ratio and the therapeutic gain factor. So the dose enhancement ratio is the dose of radiation alone required to produce an effect, divided by a dose of radiation to give the same effect in combination with the drug. The therapeutic gain factor is the ratio of the dose enhancement ratio for tumor over the dose enhancement ratio for normal tissue toxicity. Examining the interaction of drugs is really quite a complex process. It's hard to sometimes determine whether in fact there is a simple additive effect or whether synergy is taking place. For example, in this model from Tanner, If drug A has an effect in decreasing survival to SA and drug B to SB, and the combination decreases survival to S1, the question is there synergy which is taking place? On the face of it, it looks as though there is synergy because SA plus SB obviously is a lot less than S1. However, this is only true if there is no shoulder on the survival curve. And if there is a shoulder on the survival curve, then in fact no synergy or no true synergy may exist. The relationship between synergy and additivity and also antagonistic effects of different agents has been established by Steele and Peckham back in the ni late 1950s using isobologram analysis. Essentially, what they showed was with different doses of agent A and doses of agent B, synergy only really existed within a relatively small region, and that there was a large balloon of additivity which existed whenever two agents were combined. This envelope of additivity is derived by looking at the effect of each individual agent alone and establishing on that basis the relationship of a dose of agent A to a dose of agent B that would be predicted to give an equal effect, in other words, an isoeffective plot. Obviously, if two or more agents have a superadditive or synergistic interaction, this is only valid for inclusion in a clinical protocol if there is some tumor cell activity involved, in other words, an improvement of the therapeutic index. It's often impossible to actually decide based on clinical information whether in fact there are interactions of a synergistic nature between different drugs. If one looks at the evolution of treatment of metastatic colorectal cancer, for example, starting with a simple supportive care, going up to multiple agents being delivered, one can see that certainly the median overall survival has a major effect upon the survival of these patients. However, it would be impossible to dissect out the effects of these agents as really all of this has been done from a purely empirical basis. The combination of chemotherapy with radiation therapy is often at the same kind of level. Certainly true that meta-analysis has shown that chemotherapy improves survival in non-metastatic head and neck cancer. This has been attributed to give about 4.4% effect at 5 years. More recently, it's been shown that concomitant radiation or chemotherapy gives an absolute benefit of 6.5 to 8% at 5 years, irrespective of the fractionation scheme which is used, even though altered fractionation has been shown to have a survival advantage and is generally better than neoadjuvant chemotherapy. In this setting, platinum-based regimens appear to be most effective. But of course, this comes with a cost of increased early and late toxicity. So we're seeing an increase in the number of trials of chemoradiation therapy. And for example, this trial by Fernell showed that the combination of chemo radiation therapy in non-small cell lung cancer was certainly showed a trend towards an improved survival rate if chemotherapy was done concurrently. However, toxicity was significantly more frequent, being increased from 3% to 32%. And in spite of this increase in toxicity, the suggestion is that this is the optimal strategy for patients with locally advanced non-small cell lung cancer. Kleinberg suggested that because of this toxicity, future improvements will likely require the incorporation of targeted agents that add minimally to existing toxicity and the use of molecular predictors of response to individualize selection of the chemotherapeutic regimen. Lin showed that concurrent chemoradiotherapy was superior to radiation therapy alone for advanced nasal pharyngeal carcinoma. But again, significantly more toxicity was noted, including leukopenia and emesis. But clearly there's a need for predictive markers of responsiveness. Recently, the role of methylation of the methylguanine methyltransferase promoter has been indicated to be important in terms of the response of patients with glioblastoma to Temodar. Patients who had a methylated promoter for this particular enzyme, MGM2 is a DNA repair enzyme, and is thought to be important in giving resistance to chemotherapy and perhaps radiation as well. There's obviously a search on for stem cell markers in order to evaluate their impact in terms of response to chemoradiation therapy. One of these, the GLI-1 marker, has been suggested to be important. It seems that GLI-1 nuclear expression is a strong independent predictor for early relapse and poor prognosis in esophageal cancer after chemoradiation therapy. And it might be that this pathway is responsible for promoting cancer regrowth and progression. One of the most obvious forms of chemoradiation therapy that might be expected to be effective is the combination of drugs which are known to be radiation sensitizers with radiation. Among these are the halogenated pyrimidines like iodeoxyuridine and bromodeoxyuridine. Activity of these agents is dependent upon incorporation into DNA, where they appear to block DNA repair. Unfortunately, so far they've shown to limited clinical usefulness, primarily due to the toxicity. The hypoxic cell sensitizers of cytotoxins are thought to primarily increase radiosensitivity of the hypoxic and not aerated cells. And targeting hypoxia still is something which has been tried in many clinical trials with radiation therapy. Part of this comes from the concept that anemia has a negative effect on outcome of radiation therapy. This has been addressed by giving blood from transfusions and also by giving erythropoietin. Unfortunately, erythropoietin has been found to potentiate tumor growth, again by working primarily upon cancer stem cells. Other approaches have included perfluorocarbon emulsions or a synthetic modifier of hemoglobins like efavirenz. Archon was very popular for a while, this combination of accelerated radiation with carbogen and nicotinamide, with the aim really of combating both acute and chronic hypoxia. And of course, hyperbaric oxygen was traditionally used as one of the classic ways of targeting hypoxia. Unfortunately, none of these have been terribly effective. Nitrimidazoles have been studied extensively as radiation sensitizers. Misoniazole has certainly worked well in vitro and in vivo in preclinical models. In clinical trials, however, for the most part, it's shown to have no real benefit. There is dose-limiting toxicity of peripheral neuropathy as well, which reduces the tolerated dose. However, as already has been said in a meta-analysis by Overgaard, suggested that hypoxia was certainly a problem in squamous cell carcinomas, but less of a problem in adenocarcinomas. Also showed that there was an improvement in local control as a result of targeting. The other hope for targeting hypoxia in combination with radiation was really to use the hypoxic cytotoxins. Perhaps one would expect that these cytotoxins would certainly not have, be likely to have a synergistic effect with radiation. However, by removing a radiation-resistant population, they would be of value. Mitomycin C was shown to be a relatively poor hypoxic cell sensitizer because it required very low levels of oxygen for maximal cytotoxicity. Tirapasmine was a much more effective molecule. However, this agent also eventually failed due to toxicity. Radioprotectors have always had an appeal for radiation oncologists and radiobiologists alike. The major radioprotector groups came initially from the WR compounds. WR-638 was oral tablets carried by Soviet troops and are still carried by Soviet troops. Unfortunately, require intravenous or intraperitoneal administration to be effective. WR-1607 has cardiotoxicity and is now marketed as DECON, the rat poison. WR-2721 is the classic radioprotector, also known as amifostine. This is a prodrug which requires to be dephosphorylated in order to be effective, the effective compound being known as WR-1065. This has been shown in preclinical studies to differential protection of normal tissues, primarily due to the fact that it isn't delivered very well into tumours. In order, of course, for this strategy to be effective, one would need to increase the radiation dose. The drug became an orphan drug some years ago and was taken up by MedImmune and has been reinvented for xerostomia as the RTOG phase 3 clinical trial ongoing. There appears to be some benefit, although toxicity is still an issue, as is the fear of protecting tumour. The mechanisms by which these drugs act appear to be either scavenging of free radicals or by hydrogen atom donation to radicals in target molecules, in other words, by chemical repair. It's certainly very clear that thiols are important in terms of radiation responses in vivo and in vitro. And in vitro, a large number of thiol compounds appear to be effective. Unfortunately, whenever these are given clinically, they're often associated with side effects. What may be an approach for these agents in the future is to deliver them as a means of preventing second cancers, which appears to require a lower dose of drug than that which is needed for radioprotection.